Session number 9876, Reel 9.
Mr. Dennis, Reel 9. We've been looking at the events, the sort of background to your life in the salient during the Third Battle of Ypres. Now, and how things worked, and we'd now like really to move on to back into the sequence of events.
Yes.
If you could pick up, I think you've covered most of the things that happened to you in Ypres, and that's anything you
want
to.
Well, there's a bit more on them. We moved up following one of the offensives, one of the local offensives. We moved up from the Admiral's Road position to a position in St. Julian Village. That is the ruins of St. Julian. It was on the banks of the Steenbeek, and the engineers had made a very, very clever Decaville railway on which we could mount our howitzers, and we could get them into our position in St. Julian.
Was not the Decaville Railway subject to a lot of shelling? It would surely be visible, as it
was. Oh, yes. I know. It was mended when it was broken, that's all. But it certainly was terribly conspicuous, yes. Well, we were in St. Julian, carrying out the usual things. And one day I got a summons to report to Brigade Headquarters. And there I was told that the brigadier, who was a charming old dunderhead, old he seemed to me in those days, he had got the idea that we ought to dig a communication trench up the Pilcombe Ridge to the observation post at the top. Because it was so dangerous going to and fro. And the silly old man didn't realize that you couldn't dig a trench like that. It would took a very long time and a great deal of riveting materials, iron and so on. It would work of months. And his idea was that we should dig it in one night. And so he said that I was to have a party drawn from all the batteries in the brigade, 30 men, with picks and shovels, and go off at night and be met by an infantry runner who knew the district, supposed to be a geological expert, I suppose. And then I was to dig a communication trench up Pilcombe Ridge. Well, this is a silly thing to happen, but it's an order. I've got to do it. So I started out, and on the way I got a message that one of my party had been caught by a shell, and several of them had been wounded, and I must go on with the remainder. So I went on with the remainder. And it became dark and raining. And I couldn't tell where the hell we were. And the infantry runner, as they always were, lost. So he wasn't any help to us. And there we were on the Pilcombe Ridge. Quite impossible to even start doing the trench. So we wandered about looking for where we were, really. And presently, through the murk and the mist and the rain and so on, I saw a great pile of rubble, brick rubble. And I realized that this was had once been a farmhouse, but it wasn't in our line. It's one one that I had seen from our own observation post in the German land. So I realized that I'd landed these men well outside our line. We must have gone through without being seen. And I was somewhere in no man's land, or else I was behind the Germans. I wasn't quite sure which it was. So anyway, the thing to do was to try and get out of this trouble. So I thought I should lose the men in this if we're not jolly careful. So I made them, each man, hold the belt of the man in front of them. I led this sort of ignominious caterpillar. My only direction was that I had to go away from the very lights that I could see in the sky, because they were obviously at the front. And so I led this caterpillar to a place where I found that there was a concreted pillbox, the Germans. And I asked the machine gun, I think, in it, if I could have some shelter for my chaps, and he said no. So I went on a bit further and found the Germans, in their beautifully industrious way, had concreted a trench, and that was available for us. It was wet, but it was safe, and I sort of bedded them down there for the night. And in the dawn, which was not a very good dawn, we staggered back to brigade headquarters, and I reported that I had dug the trench, I'd got lost, and so on. I got this frightful rocket for inefficiency and God knows what. And another subaltern was sent for to take another party out the next night and do it all over again properly. Well, he was an old chap, as subalterns went, and so he said, "Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Tonight, sir. Half past seven. Yes, sir. Report tomorrow, sir. Yes, sir." And he got his party, and he didn't make the slightest attempt to go to Pilcombe Ridge. He had reconnoitred the ground and located a pillbox which he could get into. He took these men straight to the pillbox and left them there until the morning. He came back and he reported and he saluted. He did it all in the proper military fashion and said that he had been unable from circumstances outside his control. And so he got a terrible rocket, but the colonel got the message, and we got no more nonsense of that kind. Then the silly old man got hit in the bottom in some piece of shell and had to go off, so we saw him no more, and he was replaced by excellent chap, who was the commander of one of the batteries.
Do you remember his name, either of them's name, the old one or the new one?
I can't remember the old man's name, like O'Donnell. The new man was, I can't remember it either.
Fair enough, it's a long time to remember.
But anyway, he was very good, and very good commander for us, and we had no nonsense from then on.
Talking about officers, one point out, you twice now mentioned that the captain was never there.
Yeah.
That he was always on courses and things.
Yes.
Was there any perhaps background reason for that, or was this just coincidence?
I think it was just coincidence. I can't suggest any reason. I think possibly, of course, that if the major in command had wanted to, he could have nagged continually in staff quarters to have a man sent, but he didn't want one, because he preferred to have me going about with him. We later, long later in the war, we got a they got a captain, and he was a disaster when he came. He was one of these chaps who couldn't refrain from nagging at the troops all the time. Whatever they did, he nagged at them, and they hated him, and he nagged at us too, those of us who were subalterns, and we hated him. And but it was only at the very end.
Did anything else happen during Third Ypres, or before you had your
before I dug the communication trench? Silly little story that I'll tell you. You can leave it out if it's too trivial. But one rather grim evening, I was in my forward observation post, which was a shell hole. On the Pilcombe Ridge, I think. And there was a large pillbox nearby where there was it was the headquarters of a battalion of the Guards. And I became aware of this by the fact that about 7:30, a very smart soldier appeared from the direction of the pillbox, gave me a proper guard salute, and said, Captain so-and-so's compliments, sir. He was the adjutant. And he would be pleased if you would do him the pleasure of dining with him this evening. And I looked up from this hole, for I was covered with mud, and I said, well, will you please give my compliments to Captain so-and-so and tell him that I should have very much enjoyed accepting his invitation, but I've just received an order to report back to my brigade, so I'm afraid I can't go. But I thought it was so typical of the Guards. I mean, carry on that kind of routine when in the middle of a kind of mess of mud and blood and shellfire is really what makes them what they are.
What did you think? I mean, I know you had a worm's eye view, so to speak, at the time. What did you think of the point of the whole of the Third Ypres and Passchendaele, as it later on became known?
Of course, it was a disaster due to the failure, I think, of high command people to spend enough time in forward areas looking at things, and a terrible misconception about what the weather in Flanders, which they thought was going to be fine, it resulted in an attempt to carry out an offensive which couldn't be carried out in the circumstances.
Did you realise that at the time?
Oh yes, we all knew that it was hopeless. Oh yes, we all knew this, and so did the poor issued infantry too. They knew very well what they were being sacrificed. I mean, I remember an occasion on which a battalion of the Artists Rifles near us was ordered to carry out a small, highly local attack across a piece of ground which you couldn't have walked on if there'd been no enemy, because it was so wet. And they simply got out from their holes or where they were, and they were all shot down, and that was that. That was the sort of nonsense that happened. Of course,
who did you blame for this? Did you blame the generals and the staff, or how did you feel about all that?
I thought we were somebody being damn foolish. Of course, the generals, they were extraordinarily different. I mean, we were in the 18th Corps, which was whose commanding general was a silly man, a foolish, pompous man. But we were moved from corps to corps we remained on the ground, and then the corps changed. Then we got in the 2nd Corps, whose commander, General Jacob, was a terribly good commander. And then we had a little time in the Canadian Corps, where I can remember that the food was markedly better because they did our rations.
In what way was it better?
Oh, it was more varied and more palatable, and also the staff work was extremely well done, which it wasn't in the 18th Corps. Second Corps, it was well done.
How did you get on with the Canadians?
I never met them intimately. Our contact with them was very casual and quick. All I can say is it's all right as far as I know, but we didn't get to know them as we did the Australians,
when were you with them after Eve?
In 1918, I've got a story about this.
Now, while you were with Second Corps, that was Jacobs, I believe you actually paid a visit to headquarters.
Yes. General Jacob had a way of always having at his headquarters, which was a chateau behind the line, he always had a subaltern from some unit, infantry it might be, and he used, I think he did this partly because he liked to give chaps who'd had a bad time a good time, and partly because he liked to get from them, rather than through official channels, an idea of what the morale of the troops was like. I think in my case it probably also I may have been picked out because my father and mother had known Jacob well in long days gone by, but he did invite me.
Was this
there.
Before you came out? This is while he was still in the line?
I was just withdrawn for a week.
And what happened exactly?
Well, I arrived at headquarters at the chateau, and a subaltern met me and was very kind of welcoming and pleasant. And I discovered that whereas I'd had the idea that the staffs of corps and so on were idle, overfed people living in luxury and comfort, that in fact all Jacob's staff officers were people who'd served in the line, and most of them had been wounded. So they were quite different from my sort of naive ideas of staff officers. But mind you, there were staff officers that corresponded to my ideas, but not in that corps. Well, in the evening, the corps mess was having its dinner, and I found myself in the most exalted company. All around me was scarlet and gold and crowns and medals and all this kind of thing. I said, oh my God, what have I got in for? I was given a whiskey, and the mess waiter brought me round a siphon, and I didn't know that the siphon had a hair trigger on it. I pressed it too hard, and the result was there was a shoosh of soda water all over me, all over. I don't know how many eminent staff officers drenched with this stuff, but much light was made of it, and much amusement was caused, and they were very, obviously very anxious, as I shouldn't feel as I would normally feel, totally cast down by this thing. And after dinner, General Jacob asked me to come round, and he talked to me a bit, and I found that what he was very anxious to know was what the impressions I'd got of the feelings of the troops going round. Particularly, he wanted to know about the gunners with whom I served, and the infantry whom I'd come across in my visits to the infantry headquarters and that. and he asked me essentially to what extent I thought the Battle of Ypres had done him in. He had known, of course, that it was a tumor.
Did he let you see that he thought that?
Oh yes, he let me see that. He let me. He was careful what he said, but he let me see that. I couldn't fail to notice that he got a critical attitude to it. But I was able to tell him that I thought the censoring of the letters was one way of telling what the morale of the troops was like, and that there was, I said that I think there's no doubt about it that they are very disappointed. They'd hoped for a good thing in this offensive and they haven't got it, but I don't see any collapse. And he told me that that what really mattered, if you were trying to assess morale, was when things went very badly wrong, whether you got cases of large bodies of men surrendering without fighting, or only individuals. And he said that there had been a very bad case where a French Mount Kemmel, and he said that he told me this was not my publication, but he told me that they had unfortunately surrendered in groups of 50 or so at a time, which he said was quite inadmissible. Our own divisions had tried to recapture Mount Kemmel, but hadn't succeeded. However, that's for 1918, what happened then.
What did you tell him then in the end? About?
I told him that I didn't think there was the slightest fear that the rank and file were going to stop fighting or prove impossible.
Did you believe that, or was that what you thought he wanted to hear?
No, I believed it, and I was. The events showed that I was right.
What else did you tell him?
What did happen, though, was that at the very last stages of the war, when we knew the war was only was petering out rapidly, everybody was extremely unwilling to get into danger.
We'll come to that, of course, but it's good.
And we followed, the Germans retreated as fast as they could go, and we followed them as slow as we could go.
Do you remember, what impression did Jacobs has obviously made a good impression of you,
yes,
from things you said, but can you broaden the picture a little about him, about what sort of a man he was? I realise it's a very brief
encounter. The thing about Jacob really was that he was an Indian Army officer, and that tends, I think, to give them a wider perspective than those who have served only in the British Army. He was also more of an intellectual, I think. Like, in that respect, he was like the Australian commander who was like that.
Monash,
yes. I think he too was something up there, which some didn't.
Was he a nice man?
Oh yes, he was a nice and very humane man, Jacob.
During the actual dinner party session, or the mess, more correctly, during the mess, were what were the topics of conversation? Because you were a bit outgunned, as you said.
Well, I think, I can't remember, you know, but I my impression is that they kept it very light, and they were following the old army rule that everything has to be able to put a guest at his ease, and I think they probably avoided conversation which would have been over my head. But the they were like the you know the case of the mess where they had to entertain a Labour politician, and he started to eat what was it? Eat something with his fingers, which he should have. And the story is that the commanding officer next to him instantly followed suit and looked carefully around the table, and everybody did. So it was never known. All right, that's it.
And they behaved in a similar fashion to accept conversation.
Don't think they thought about it, really. The conversations met usually wasn't professional, even if there'd been no subaltern there.
You were the only subaltern?
I was the only one.
Had you had to get a special uniform or anything, or were you just in your...
Oh, no, I was in my ordinary khaki. Oh, no. No, I don't think special uniforms were ever worn at all.
Now, after this, is there anything else before you were sent, the battery pulled out, or rather?
We were pulled out at Christmas from Ypres.
Did you pull the guns out, or were they left in position?
I think we brought our guns with us. Because when one of the batteries in the brigade was leaving, it was attacked. This was unusual at the time. It was attacked by a low-flying German plane and bombed from a low altitude and lost a lot of men. We thought it was rather hard luck that they should have got all the way through the Battle of Ypres and then been killed by bombing at the on the way out.
So how was the way out organised?
I don't know, really. It was all above my head, I think. But we got we were guns, of course, pulled by four-wheel drive lorries, and the men and us either in lorries or with motorcycle and sidecar. We had two in the battery, and we got out to this little place called Esquil Beck, which was a tiny little place in the out of the world in Flanders, nice and away from sights of warfare, but it was snowing like anything, and we were billeted as a farmhouse, and I used to try and talk to the Flemish farmer, not realizing sufficiently that French wouldn't be his language. It wasn't any more his language than it was mine. I realized there was something about the language, because I pointed out to what was coming down from the sky and said to him, "Est-ce que vous l'appelez la neige?" And he said, "No, snow." Well, we were pulled out. We did a little training at Esquil Beck, badly needed, because we really rather...
What sort of training was it you were in?
Oh, gun drill and getting the lines of fire straight and that kind of thing. Not firing.
I think you have a story about cherry brandy there.
But we were terribly cold. And we used to drink cherry brandy, which we bought in the nearest Flemish town. I remember this visiting senior officer who looked round and said, "I don't like to see you young gentlemen drinking cherry brandy in the morning. No one drinks cherry brandy in the morning except whores."
Did the rest at Esquilbeck, did it improve morale?
Oh yes, I think so. Morale was not really bad. It wasn't a question of kind of getting the morale off the bottom, because it wasn't at the bottom. It was not too bad. But certainly the rest helped.
Did you, you mentioned Christmas celebrations earlier. Were you at Esquilbeck when you had those?
I think we must have been. I have a sort of impression that I got tight at Esquilbeck on Christmas Eve. And the story was that I serenaded the brigade commander in a drunken voice. But I can't give you chapter and verse.